You're about to hear Michael Moore, director of Bowling for Columbine and Roger and Me, and the author of Stupid White Men, give a keynote speech at Webzine 2001 last summer in the basement of CBGB's in New York City. Webzine is an annual event celebrating independent publishing on the internet. It is a 100% volunteer-driven event and features hundreds of the leading independent online media creators around the globe. For more information on the Webzine event and how you can start one in your own city, visit our website at www.webzine.ws. Now, here's Michael Moore.
I want to introduce the great Michael Moore. Come on up, man. Grab the mic, it's all yours.
Well, thanks for having me here. And some people called and asked me if I would come and talk about my experience using the internet and our website and our little thing that we do. So, first of all, I just I'm a member of this, the baby boom generation, I guess. And I know. It's truly, somebody needs to, do something about the baby boomers that are still in charge or ruining the world. My generation is like the single greatest force against anything new or good happening. I don't know how many people I know, how many friends of mine are just still put down the internet or don't even want to learn how to use it or get involved in it, and they all love to talk about now how the internet's all failing or the .com thing is ending or whatever. I don't, some kind of bullshit that they like to believe is true. Because I'm one of that generation, I share a certain amount of that ignorance. And I didn't really myself understand what was going on until maybe about 1994. We had TV Nation. It was the show that we had on NBC. And my wife was really into the internet and computers, and she was working on computers back in the mid-70s. She logged on after one of our shows was over one night to a message board or a chat room or whatever. And this would be 94, so it still wasn't, it hadn't really kind of exploded at that point. But I was just stunned how minutes later after the show ended that people were talking about these things that we just aired on television. And it was such, up until this point, up until the invention of this thing, this ability for all of us to communicate with each other without the middleman, if you had a show on national television, it was all a one-way thing. I would put my thing out to you, and that would be the end of it. Man, maybe you'd get a few fan letters, but I'd never write a fan letter, and most of you probably wouldn't write a fan letter. So, you never really heard from the bulk of the people watching the show. And so to see these literally hundreds of comments and discussion taking place within minutes after the show is over, really blew my mind. And So we put up my wife's email address in this discussion, and the next day she had 300 emails from people. And right away I began to see that this is truly one of the greatest things to happen in my lifetime, because the egalitarian nature of this is such suddenly, before, if you wanted to, let's say if you wanted to say something to the country, you would have to do what I had to do, which was somehow, go barreling headfirst through some door in Hollywood, and come out, bloodied and bruised and battered, and in the hopes of getting, your thing on TV. And I'm a rare fluke and an exception to people like us, because people like us aren't supposed to be on TV. We're not, and our films are not supposed to be distributed by Hollywood studios. That's just not the way it's set up. And so because of whoever was asleep at the wheel or whatever mistake was made that I was able to get in, once in, I figured I better try and do some good or create some havoc here or get some other people in through the door. while I had it slightly ajar. So I began to see that this whole thing with the web and the internet, it was just like this incredible thing where you no longer had to go and make a pitch to some Hollywood executive to be able to speak to millions of people. That there was a device to do that. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, probably to most of the people in this room, it's you're well aware of how incredible the last decade is in terms of what's happened. But I don't think really those who write about our culture and the culture police whose job it is to stop us really fully comprehend the incredible revolution that has taken place. Because never before in the history of mankind have human beings been able to communicate on a mass level to other human beings without going through the owners of whatever the device was that got the word out. You know, whether it was the people that, you know, ran City Hall or the people who owned the newspaper, you could send a letter to the editor, but they would determine whether or not the letter would be published and what of it would be published. If you wanted to get something on television, you could go to your cable access station maybe and get something on it at 2 in the morning and have 17 people see it. But with radio, there was a time, and I feel that what we're going through now is very much like the early days of FM radio, which maybe a lot of you aren't old enough to remember what that was like, but it was FM was considered some bastard stepchild of the form of radio, and so it wasn't really used much. Yet there were all these frequencies that existed, and people would start up stations and just start playing whatever they wanted to play, in whatever order they wanted to play it in. There was actually a time when that happened, and that new voices could be heard. And if my buddies and I, if we had a band back in high school, we could literally drive over to the radio station with a tape and get it played on the air. That actually happened. That now one company owns, well actually two companies own virtually all the radio stations, the commercial radio stations in this country. These two companies now are up to owning 75% of all the radio stations. So it all sounds alike and it all sounds like crap. And because it's mostly people in my generation that are these owners, they make sure that no new voices, no new bands, no new music ever really gets heard. Or if it's heard, it's put into some sort of niche, you know, some alternative kind of, you know, freaky, fringy thing that's off there, but not considered standard or mainstream or available to the general public. So this has never happened before, you know, other than in those few short years with FM radio, where the people could actually communicate with each other and on a mass scale, not just writing a letter to a friend and putting a stamp on it, you know, or posting your grievances on the wall that, you know, maybe a few hundred people would see that. Or maybe there would be a large rally or a demonstration in Washington, D.C. Maybe you would end up speaking to 100,000 people. But what amazed me is that back in 1994, with this initial experience, is that within a few short weeks, and NBC was deciding whether or not to keep the show on the air, we just put the word out on our we didn't have a site then, it was just through my wife's email address and on these message boards, that NBC was thinking of not renewing the show. And so within, I think, maybe 5 days, NBC received over 55,000 emails from people around the country. Now, this is 1994, so again, you got to remember, it still wasn't at the explosive, you know, and mass stage that it's at now. And it totally flipped them out at NBC. And in fact, they offered us to come back as a result of these emails, and we came back in December and did an end-of-the-year special. And then more mail came in, and we took the sacks of these emails over to Fox to see if we could even get a better deal with them, and they did, and they put us on over at Fox. So the internet was responsible for all that, the people, you know, having their say and letting the network know in a way that went way, but you got to understand, if a show on television gets maybe 10 letters, they think that's like a revolution going on. You know, like 10 anti, you know, abortion people will send a letter and, you know, they'll just go nuts and start pulling everything, you know, from like 10 letters. So to get 55,000 letters, it had never happened before. Nothing they had ever put on the air had ever received 55,000 of anything, even phone calls. It had topped anything in there. Nothing had nothing in their experience to relate to this. So it certainly showed me that this had this is way beyond anything you could ever hope for. And it's not just about, geez, how could we send letters to get a stupid TV show on the air, but rather that if we somehow can keep this in our hands, that it's a very powerful force. And of course, the other powerful forces out there, those of commerce and of the political establishment in Washington, their goal is to figure out how to use the internet for their best interests, to make money and to control us. And so the battle is raging, essentially, and we're right in it right now. You know, will this remain? Will this be this egalitarian device, this revolutionary thing that allows all of us to communicate with each other, to organize, to get together, to do whatever it is that we want to do and say whatever it is we want to say without censorship, you know, or will the forces of evil win and control it, stifle it, segregate it, and continue to make sure that the, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but the, you know, I mean, how many people in the country now have are on the internet, are hooked in? Is it, what's 50% maybe? 60? It's somewhere in there. But that means that there's another half of the country that's not wired. There's another half of the country that's not hooked up. And when at the end of this, my last documentary, the big one, and there's a scene where talking to Phil Knight about the children that he uses in his sweatshops in Asia, and I challenge him to come and build a factory in the third world of Flint, Michigan, and he won't do that. But he, I then, so why don't you give some money to the schools? And he says, I'm not going to do that. And I said, well, I'll put up $10,000 if you put up $10,000 for a school in Flint. And he said, okay, I'll do that. So we took the $20,000 and built a computer lab at the poorest elementary school in Flint. And I went to see the principal there, and I said, how many do you think of your kids here are online at home or on the internet, have computers and are hooked up? She said, oh, I think it's between 1% and 2%. 1% and 2%. And that, in other words, 98% of these kids are not either computer literate or have access. That's correct. So we thought, we'll bring all these computers into the school and get these kids hooked up and to try and catch up. But none of us should see any of this really as a victory yet, when half of us have the ability to do this and the other half don't. And that's what the previous generations did. That's what they made sure that a certain elite had the means, the ability to communicate, to travel, to educate, to do whatever, and the have-nots remain the have-nots. So that's another challenge of this new revolution and of your generation, to see to it that we don't just sit here and throw a party for this great thing that we're part of, but that we recognize that millions and millions of other people are not part of this party, and we must bring them into it. Because once they're into it, once they're part of this, then it becomes really scary, because they're the ones who really are on the shit end of what's going on in this country right now. And once we're able to organize with them and they with us, that is going to be an incredibly powerful moment. And the chance to try and create social or political change is absolutely incredible. Since that time in 94, I've had many experiences, too numerous really to cite, in terms of once we got a website set up and started putting the word out about different things, whether it was a demonstration taking place here or a letter campaign that needed to start there or some kind of ruckus that people needed to create wherever. It was amazing that by getting the word out, how many people you literally could get to show up at a demonstration the very next day. There was this one thing we did where we organized this in we just said, you know, show up at the local, if there's any kind of like, you know, Murdoch affiliate or anything that's owned by Rupert Murdoch, the next day at noon, people around the country are going to show up and protest the particular thing. And we got reports back from about 42, 43 cities that had some sort of protest, whether they went to their local Fox affiliate or whatever. And it was an amazing thing to see, because I remember, you know, again, in my generation, if you wanted to organize, a demonstration, a nationwide demonstration, it would be months and months of work just to get the word out and to figure out how to get everybody someplace. And the fact that can happen literally within hours now is something that the powers that be just must not like. And we need to see the power of that. We need to see that the incredible power that we have in our hands here that we can hopefully do some good with. I would assume most of the people here, I've only talked to a few people since I came in, but I assume most of you are, you know, pretty well versed, and you know you have your own sites, you have your own zines, you have, you know, you're into this pretty deep, and I would think that the next level that we all need to figure out where to take this to is how to get this beyond, in maybe many of your cases, just a small group of friends or people in your communities, to an even larger and wider group of people, and I hope that's being discussed, and I hope that you know, together we can find these ways to make this thing move and move in a way that reaches as many people as possible and cuts out the middleman as much as possible. Now, I started my first underground paper when I was in fourth grade. The nuns, I was in Catholic school, the nuns shut it down. I started up again in sixth grade, the nuns shut it down again. I started again in eighth grade, the priest shut it down in eighth grade. But I've always enjoyed writing, and I've always liked just the power of the word and being able to figure out ways to communicate to an audience and not just preach to the converted, not just have some kind of jerk-off fest with each other so that we all sit around and nod in agreement, but to really try and reach as wide of an audience as possible and realize that there are people out there that maybe they aren't as far along as you are, but the doors are open and they're listening and they're willing to listen and they want to hear things, and we have to find ways to say those things so that it's not just the same group of people over and over again trying to make change occur in this country. I started up my own regular newspaper, a weekly alternative paper called the Flint Voice, when I was, 22 years old. And I did that for about 10 years. In the middle of that, we ran a story about 5 years into it on the local mayor in Flint and some of the illegal things that he was doing. And he got wind of the article and got a court order from the judge. And the police went in and seized the printing plates right off the press of the printer that we used to print the paper. And this created a big ruckus, and it was made national news. And the whole thing ended up going to Congress and testifying, and a bill was passed, a shield law, to protect journalists from unreasonable newsroom searches from police. So I had a very early experience with this, with how those in power want to put a stop to anything that they don't think is in their best interest. And of course, we weren't wealthy enough to own the presses then. The printing presses cost quite a bit of money. And I remember actually when we finally could afford to pay a monthly fee for what was called a CompuGraphic typesetting machine. And these things were like still, it's like $70,000, $80,000. And I don't know, we paid like $500 a month on it. And it was just some horrible, you know, amount of money that we couldn't afford. But at least we own, you know, like part of the means, you know, the old cliche about freedom of the press is for those who own the presses, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. And the police could literally go in and take that off the press. Now, with the internet, it's a little harder for them. As you've heard here today and before I spoke, they still like to go in and seize things. They're just inclined to do that. Just, I don't know, whatever it is in their DNA, in their nature or whatever, but they're just the thought police, and who are oftentimes real police, like to go in and take things that aren't theirs. You know, we need to fight that and stand up against that and oppose that and get laws passed so that your computer has the same protections that the newsrooms of America have based on this law that I and others worked to get enacted back many years ago. I don't know. I don't know if we should open some questions here, or if I can tell you some more stories, or I don't know. I like to actually be helpful. So I didn't have a chance to talk to a lot of people here, so I'm not quite sure, you know, what would be helpful to the group here. But do you want to? Yeah, and we can get a discussion going. And you should also let me have it. I mean, you know, ask me why I'm on AOL. You know, just you know. why do I eat? How do you know my eating habits? Oh, she wanted to know, in the big one, there's a scene in there of me eating at McDonald's. I put that in there because I wanted to show that I'm a flawed human being. The last thing I want is for... No, that is all it is. Yeah, I like you, am filled with many contradictions, and I don't like people to make movies and do things to turn themselves into some sort of star or celebrity that's up on some kind of pedestal. I'm horribly flawed and in need of a lot of help. That's why I put it in the movie. That's the truth. Yeah.
All right. Well, I know it's not cool to be a fan, but
you have
a
microphone and a drink in your hand.
Yeah,
dangerous combination.
And I'm pretty damn lit too. I just want you all to know. Former panelists getting liquored up here. You don't. I'm not wearing underwear. You don't want to see it. Anyway, my name is Bill Lessard, and I run a site called netslaves.com.
Yes.
And myself and this gentleman right there, raise your hand, get some props. We wrote a book called Net Slaves, True Tales of Working the Web, and we wrote this book.
I own that book.
Come on, dude. You're kissing my ass.
No.
I'm supposed to kiss your ass.
No. I'm really honored to meet you, actually. I love...
Are you swear? Come
yes,
on, dude.
No,
really?
True. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I got to tell you... No, I shouldn't tell you.
We wrote that book in 3 months. I know it kind of sucks at certain points, but, you know, we did our best. But anyway, here's my question. The situation that a lot of dot-com workers are going through are analogous. It's currently analogous to what happened, you know, in Flint, Michigan. I mean, a lot of people are out of work. I mean, myself, I don't know where my next dollar is coming from. See, it's the liquor talking. What would you say to us to, like, how what inspiring words or something just to keep ourselves going? I mean, what would you say, really?
Drink less.
No, come on, dude. Seriously, what would you say?
I would say that it's not analogous to Flint of the late 1990s. But it is analogous to Flint of 1910. In 1910, there were something like 65 auto companies in America. 65. 65 separate, different automobile companies. It eventually became three. And now two, if you count the Mercedes people as being Germans. Because I don't see it that way. I just see, they don't see themselves as Americans or Germans or whatever. They're part of a global thing, and they could give a shit. So this part of this is a natural thing in terms of if you have 1,000 .coms, it's not going to, it's not ever going to be 1,000 .coms. It's going to be less. Hopefully, it'll never be 3, but it won't be 1,000. So I think that the solution for you or for the average worker in these various in this industry is to, instead of waiting around for the man or whoever that person is that, you know, has got a trust fund and that's going to start the next .com to then hire the next 100 people only to fire them a year later, that it behooves you and it is incumbent upon you and others here to realize that you yourself can create your own thing, that you can actually create, that you have it within you. I mean, this sounds like a fucking, you know, Tom, or what's that guy's name, that Robbins guy on late night TV?
Tony Robbins.
Yes, you! but listen, but we are taught from the time we are little kids that we're shit, and that we can't do shit, can I just give you my thoughts about this, actually, because you know, can I just go off for a second here? Because
dude, feel free to free associate, dude.
I just think this is what I don't know. In the first 5 years of our lives, we learn more, and it's downhill after that. I mean, because it is. Think about this: when you're born, you don't know anything. And by the time they shove you into kindergarten or preschool, you have learned so many things on your own without the benefit of a teacher, a textbook, a desk, a test, a grading system, a state, you know, authorized test. You know, you don't. When you're born, you can't speak. By the time you're 5, you have a vocabulary of 3,000 to 5,000 words. You have learned to speak a foreign language. You speak in complete sentences, paragraphs. You can communicate pretty clearly with adults. How did you do that? How did you learn a foreign language without going to school in those first 5 years? You did it through trial and error. Because in our first 5 years, it's okay to fuck up. It's okay to make a mistake. In fact, we're rewarded for it. You learn, that's how we're supposed to learn as humans. We're supposed to learn from our mistakes. As soon as you're put in first grade, though, it's like, you know, if you make any mistakes, you're flunked. You know, you're put in the bluebird group, you know, or the blackbird group, or whatever group you were put in, and you're tracked and you're fucked for the rest of your life, you know. But in the first 5 years, when you're trying to learn to speak the foreign language, it starts off where you're going goo goo gaga, and the adults around you don't go goo goo gaga. What the hell is that? Go to your room. You know, they nurture us. They love us. They don't flunk us. They go mama dada, and then we go mama dada. You know, then we try to walk and we fall down. And when we fall down, the parents don't go, what the fuck are you doing? You know, get up. They don't do that. They help us up, or they put little chairs, little stools around so we can like hold on, you know, and walk around. And eventually, you know, we fall down. They don't sit there with their martinis just having a laugh at us. Oh, look at that shithead falling on his face again. That's not how it is. You know, it's they you know, they help us. They help us. And every time we fail, we're loved. Every time we fail in those first 5 years, we're nurtured. And then we go to school. And then every time you fail, you're screwed. To the point to where now, as an adult, you wouldn't even think of starting your own thing. You wouldn't even, the fear of failure, the fear of fucking up, the fear of falling on your face is so intense in all of us that we've lost that sense of that it's good to fail. I need to fall on my face 3 or 4 times to figure out what's wrong. You know, I need to look at myself eating that Big Mac 1,000 times in the editing room to figure out what the fuck is wrong with me. You know, I mean, and I just feel that the whole system is geared and set up. And you could, and if you, any of you are around any little kids or you have kids, you know what it's like to see a group of 4 or 5 year olds all excited and in love with life, and then walk through any high school in America, and look at the juniors and seniors in high school shuffling through the hall, completely burned out, stoned literally or figuratively. Just, you know, I don't know, I'm going to go out in the smoking area and just, you know. I mean, that's, and it's just, it's like an invisible hypodermic needle's been put into our heads at 5 years old, and slowly it sucks, just goes right into our heads and numbs us out. And then we're shoved out in the real world and told, let's, you know, go participate now, go be citizens. And it's no surprise to me that the majority of young people don't vote or don't even think about doing something on their own that they could do. And I hated school. I couldn't stand it. I got in a lot of trouble. I kept my grades up so I wouldn't get punished for the trouble I caused. And it's the only thing where they don't know what to do with you, if any of you had that experience, where if you got A's and B's, you could, you know, create a lot of trouble and don't get caught smoking or any of those other rules that they set up to get rid of the troublemakers. Because it's not really the smoking they care about, because they all smoke themselves. It's not the drinking they care about. They all drink themselves. They just know that the troublemakers will tend to do those things, and so they, you know, that's how we're able to get rid of the people that are going to give us crap, because we want nice, sedate students who aren't going to rock the boat. Don't question authority. You can't fight City Hall, you know. That's the message. It's over and over and over and over again. I just spent a week out at Columbine because I've been making this documentary called Bowling for Columbine. The title of it comes from the fact that the Eric and Dylan, the two kids that did the killings that day, the one class I didn't want to miss that morning was a bowling class. And so they showed up for their first hour bowling class and went from, you know, one All-American sport to the other All-American sport. But I met these kids there. One of them's in a wheelchair, and another one is he's got a bullet lodged between his spine and his aorta. The other bullet in the kid in the wheelchair is lodged in his stomach. And the bullets were bought over the counter at Kmart. So I said to the kids, you know, why don't we get on a plane and go to Detroit? Because that's where the Kmart world headquarters is, outside of Detroit. Why don't we return the bullets that are inside you? They said, great. So we just got on a plane, flew to Detroit. I wheeled them into the Kmart lobby and said, we're here to return your blue light special. We're not leaving until you stop selling ammunition for handguns and assault weapons in your stores. We stayed there for 5 hours. The chairman wouldn't see us. Came back the next day. The next day we came back. One of the kids that night went to the Kmart closest to the world headquarters. He bought 1,000 rounds of live ammunition over the counter, including hollow points, 357 magnums, 9mm. And we wheeled into Kmart in the wheelchairs and plopped the bullets down and said, we're not leaving until the chairman sees us. Within 2 hours, the vice president came down, and by that time a lot of press had heard about this and had gathered there and read a statement saying that within 90 days, Kmart was going to stop selling all ammunition for handguns and assault weapons. Bravo! And that took 24 hours. And these kids, these teenagers, you know, we were talking afterwards. They're so blown away by the fact that just literally a plane ticket to Detroit and a 24-hour wait resulted in a massive change in policy at the second largest chain in America. That they were humiliated and forced to make this change by these kids who are crippled by these 17-cent bullets. And I said, you know, I can't wait till we put this in the movie, because the one thing I want kids, young people, teenagers to see when they see this film is that everything you've been told about how you can't fight City Hall, that you're just one person, that there's 280 million people in this country, you're just a little speck. You don't matter. You're insignificant. It doesn't. Why bother with that? Let's party. You know, it does matter. You do matter. You, one person, can make a difference. And history is filled with examples of where just one or two people have made the difference. The big massive changes throughout world history have not occurred with armies of people. It's occurred because a black woman down in Alabama didn't want to go and sit in the back of the bus because her feet were tired. That was it. Just some tired feet and a woman who with some conviction and willing to take a risk resulted in a massive social movement in this country. You know, Marx and Engels, I mean, these are just two old farts sitting around the fire in London, warming their hands, talking shit to each other. That's all that was. I mean, by the time they were gone, they never knew anything would happen, you know. JC and his 12 guys who fished, you know? I mean, that's all they were. That's all it was. Look what that did, you know, for good or bad. Mostly bad. Some good. So, you know, I just want this. I just think that the more that you can realize that your little thing, wherever you all came from here tonight, and I assume you're all not from New York. I assume many of you came from different parts around the country. You don't count, though, because you asked me that question. she said she lives a couple blocks away. Anybody live 4 blocks away? Yeah. Oh, so you are New Yorkers. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, they'll put this on their website, and some kid in Omaha tomorrow night will see this. And that's the kid I want to say, you know, when you see this, don't let anybody in Omaha tell you, you live in Omaha, kid. Get real. This is Omaha. You're not going anywhere. You're not doing anything. This is Omaha. No, it's because it is Omaha